Radio.com.
Well, once again, everybody, thank you for joining me here on this Thursday, February 9th edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next 90 minutes or so as we go over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Happy to have you with me here for what I like to call our Thursday meeting show. Two professional handicappers join the broadcast. The first is Brad Powers of BradPowersSports.com. The second, Ralph Michaels of WagerTalk.com. And then we'll wrap up things today here with a UFC pay-per-view event this weekend. We'll get some predictions from Jay Primetown of MMAOddsBreaker.com. So that's why we've got the mega show here today. Really excited about today's broadcast. We've got three of my favorite guests. We should get a lot of great insight from these gentlemen. So let's go ahead and dive right in. We'll bring in our first guest today. That is Mr. Brad Powers of BradPowersSports.com. Bradley, how are you today, my friend?
Never been better in my entire life. Good to hear your voice on this fine Thursday morning, Adam.
Good to hear yours as well, man. And the first place I want to start here is we've had some college football news recently, and I know that the college football calendar never stops for you, and you know, you pride yourself on that. But Steve Sarkisian, now the offensive coordinator for the Atlanta Falcons. So he was with Alabama for a little while, basically doing quality control, then goes to offensive coordinator for the title game. Now he's moving on again already. So is that something that you sort of quantify in your power ratings now, or do you, you know, wait and see what the personnel is going to look like and then wait for this thing to be seen, you know, on the field?
Yeah, no reaction to my power ratings at this point for Alabama. I mean, it is a little bit of a growing concern because, you know, that's the third assistant coach that they've lost on the offensive side of the ball, and all three of them went on to be either a head coach or, you know, a coordinator in another spot. So there is going to be almost an entirely new offensive staff for Alabama for the upcoming season. And they did bring in Mike Locksley, the former New Mexico coach, known better, more for his recruiting ability than his play calling. It'll be interesting how they handle him. He was named actually the co-offensive coordinator even prior to Sarkisian leaving. So I don't know. I mean, guessing that they're going to absolutely have to bring someone else in. But right now, you know, I'm sitting in wait and see mode here for Alabama. It'll be interesting to see who they end up getting. But it's definitely not a positive for Alabama. I mean, you want to have your offense coordinator, you know, set to do it after signing day, and now you're getting, you know, relatively close to, you know, the upcoming spring practice. I mean, a lot of times you want everything in place and ready to go right around, you know, in January, even from your assistant coaches aspect. So it's something to monitor with Alabama. They still have the head guy there, and that's what matters most. They still got, you know, Jeremy Pruitt on the defensive side of the ball. I think one of the better defense coordinators. I still think they're going to be number one in my power ratings and number one in the preseason polls. But again, that's just another chink, a little slight chink in the armor. And it's not going to take too many chinks in their armor, specifically their opening game against a very good Florida State team that's already going to be much more experienced than Alabama coming into the 2017 season. It's also a Florida State team that had a great recruiting class. Obviously, Alabama had the number one class, but Florida State's not going to be short on talent and experience, and they're also not going to be intimidated by Alabama. And, boy, if Alabama has just a couple more chinks, Florida State going to be in pocket possibly for Mr. Brad Powers.
Right now, if you look in the offshore marketplace, Alabama, a 4.5-point favorite, flat juice on that over at Five Dimes, and that's the only game I see flat juice on right now. All the rest of them sitting there at minus 120, but try to work in college football every time that we can here, because I know that you miss it. I miss it. I'm sure our listeners are already missing it as well. But let's wrap up Super Bowl 51 here. Let's put a bow on the NFL season. How'd the Super Bowl work out for you?
Let's just say, you know, I wasn't a huge fan of the overtime session from a totals aspect, and obviously from New England scoring. So, that was unfortunate in that regard. The props plays, you know, slight profit there. I did end up releasing about 20 prop plays. They were relatively good to me. Individual props were all right. You know, lost some of the Atlanta individual player props. I mean, it's tough to cash a lot of them when they only have 46 offensive plays. And I was expecting some, you know, distribution to Sanu and obviously, you know, Taylor Gabriel, the backs coming out of the backfield. It was hit and miss for them. I thought I could catch more often than not. So, you know, in the end, I mean, when you lose your top play, which was the total, I mean, I did know, I thought I was right on top of the totals line move. We talked on the show prior to the Super Bowl last week that I thought the total should be 56, 57. That's where the line goes to 57 on game day. So at least I was ahead of that. Should have won. I thought it was, you know, going into it, I didn't see a tremendous amount of value on the side or total. And that usually should be the case for the Super Bowl. But, you know, there are some Super Bowls where you can get a very strong take. You know, previous year I had a relatively strong take, one of my strongest takes that I've ever had in a Super Bowl on Denver and the under. I thought it was priced pretty accordingly from the side. It played out that way as far as Atlanta being the right side for all but one play. Disappointing, to be honest with you, Adam. You prefer when you got the right side for all 60 minutes, the right total for all 60 minutes, you lose both in overtime. Wasn't a huge fan of the entire outcome, to be honest with you.
Well, and the thing that's so challenging and the thing that's such a piss off for somebody in your position is that, you know, look, we know that in a general sense, there's not a whole lot of value on the side or total for the Super Bowl. It's an incredibly sharp line. It's sitting out there for 2 weeks. Value gets extracted from it periodically if there is any value to be extracted to begin with. And, of course, we saw a lot of people think that there was value on the under. And certainly it looked like there was up until we had the big Tom Brady comeback there in the fourth quarter. But the problem is that while you know it's just another game from a handicapping aspect, and while you know that there's not a whole lot of value in it, a lot of people out there, and obviously not listeners of this show, they know better, but a lot of people out there overblow what was your last play of the NFL season. And I guarantee, however many NFL plays you made, that had to be down in the bottom 10 in terms of the strongest.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it wasn't very strong whatsoever. You know, I give kudos to my customers. I didn't take any complaints whatsoever on the overall Super Bowl performance. I like to think that I've educated my customers enough over the last couple of years. It's not always the case since I'm such a contrarian guy that when you lose, sometimes you open yourself up to some criticism just because you're going against the grain so often. But I did not. It's the one time that I didn't. But I was very forthright and candid heading into it that this isn't the game where, you know, some of the bettors put everything in. When you count all the props, they put a lot of their bankroll into the Super Bowl because they're going to have 20, 30 bets in it. But for me, it's just not one that, I mean, the props are fun in that. But to me, you know, unless you're going over, it shouldn't be affecting your overall end of season bankroll too much. And I'm just never going to be that guy that has a playoff game of the year on the Super Bowl like we see so many other, you know, fly-by-night services do stuff like that. So, you know, kudos to my customers. I give them props. I didn't take very much heat on that. And look, they know better. It's a smarter, better betting public. I mean, everyone watched it. So they saw that Atlanta and the under were, you know, the right until the final play of the game, a winning ticket for 60 plus minutes.
Well, the last thing I'll ask you here about the NFL season, then we'll start to transition a little bit more into basketball. I think I asked you this at the end of the regular season, but if I didn't, then obviously this is a pretty good place to ask it. But in terms of the NFL market, in terms of things that you learn, things that you realize work for you, things that don't, what are some of the carryovers for you heading into next season?
Well, you know, I'm not going to, you know, go too far off the beaten path. I mean, it was a year where, you know, I'm usually needing – I'm with the books more often than not. So when I need a team to win, I'm usually in the books corner compared to the public's corner. And I'll be perfectly frank. I mean, the public, you know, especially the later half of the season, you know, got the better of the books. But, you know, when I look at my overall record, you know, out of my newsletter, which I advertise on the show and you give me the opportunity to do so, and I appreciate it so much, but – when you hit 56.3% in all your plays in the NFL over the course of the regular season, and then you finish up the NFL postseason 8-3, even with the Super Bowl loss, I'm not going to change too much what I do. You got to learn some things, but you know, I'm going to throw it out there to you know, your listening audience. You know, the books were down as far – I mean, they still showed a profit, but they were down 5 or 6% this year, even with a little bit of a larger handle. Be very careful with that. I think you're going to see the books come back, particularly with what happened during the postseason and the last 3-4 weeks of the regular season. I think they'll come back, and I've seen it by following the markets over the past several years. They'll probably come back with a little bit of a vengeance. So I'm not going to change too much. I had a successful season. I kind of adjusted in the postseason. The public was hot, and you know, I thought the public was relatively sharp on a lot of those picks that they had, and I thought they had the right play in a majority of them. So, I probably am going to tweak more of my college football stuff than my NFL stuff. I was relatively happy with my NFL picks this year, Adam.
Well, we've been talking with a lot of handicappers and bettors here throughout the last couple of weeks about bankroll management. And there's something I want to ask you as we transition over to take a look at the hardwood here, both college, and we'll spend a couple seconds on the NBA as well. Do you have separate bankrolls for each sport, or do you just have one big bankroll that you pull from?
That's a great question. You know, no, I mean, you know, I'm probably lighter. You know, bankroll percentage of bankroll plays are probably a lot less than hoops, just because, you know, I'm going to be honest. I'm not world class, and I don't pretend to be world class, top of the line, best you can find in basketball. So I'm not going to be a guy that sacrifices too much of the bankroll. Football, you know, it's about the same. I mean, obviously more bankroll with college because I got more college picks, and I mean that makes sense because I mean you got five times as many games on a weekly basis. So I would say a majority of the bankroll is college football. As far as equal percent of the overall bankroll, it's equal between the NFL and college as far as an individual play basis. It's just there's more volume in college football. I do step it down a notch. I might pick it up. I usually do in March Madness because I'm a contrarian guy, and you get the public money just flooding the market. During March Madness, I mean, I can make a case that, you know, the March Madness betting public, there's probably as much in the month of March as there is November, December, January, and February combined. So I up it a little bit, but, you know, for the most part, I take it from the overall bankroll. I don't have a separate, you know, I'm not Mr. Moneybags here, Adam. Contrary to popular belief, I don't have separate $10,000, $20,000 bankrolls for each individual sport.
Well, let's talk about your betting strategy a little bit. You've said this a few times here that pretty much across most of the markets, certainly or across all the markets maybe, you do adopt a contrarian stance. And maybe some of our listeners out there, you know, obviously they know what contrarian means, but maybe they don't know what it means so much from a handicapping standpoint. So when you say that you're a contrarian bettor, what does that mean?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, it's going against, you know, popular public opinion. Let's face it. I mean, there's studies out there in the long term. You know, there's even as much as 97% of all, you know, bettors. And this is just, you know, your $5 and $10 parlay card type bettors. They lose. So in the long term, they lose. They might have some short term success, but in the long run, they lose. So I'd rather be on the opposite side of that, and I'd also like to prefer to be on the book side, especially when they've shown a profit in 41 consecutive months. So I start from there, and if you can get an extra percentage or two just from that point of, you know, fading the public and being, you know, as far as where the book needs, you know, the best, I think that's a good way to start. But, you know, I'm contrarian even. There's sometimes I'm so contrarian, Adam. If you know, I like to handicap the handicappers. I read a lot of people. I mean, I first and foremost have my own set of power ratings, my own set of beliefs and thoughts. Very strong in college football, more often than not. I don't let a lot of people talk me out of too much when it comes to college football. But you know, sometimes you know, I'm not afraid to you know, fade the handicappers. If I see four or five guys lining up all on the same play, you know, I have found, and the gentleman that you're going to have on, you know, after me has also taught me that a lot of times that's a good fade play because no individual play or team or whether it's a total should look that good. And when you see four or five people lining up on one side and it's more heavy, I'm not even – forget the public. I'm not even afraid to you know, fade the handicappers. I'm looking more for, you know, a world-class type of handicap that's so far – a deep dive that people just aren't thinking of. It's a lot of things. Sometimes I'm not afraid to fade streaks. I mean, streaks are meant to be broken. I mean, you want to play on streaks a lot of times because you can win multiple times in a row and only lose once. But sometimes I think it creates value. You got a team that's failed to cover the spread four or five games in a row. Yeah, they're facing a team that's covered the spread four or five games in a row. I think obviously that creates a lot of line value. And I'm, you know, contrarian sometimes can mean, hey, I like buying low and selling high. I mean, this is not too much. I mean, you can make a lot of comparisons with the betting markets, like you can with the stock market. So there's a lot of even thought process in that regard.
So on yesterday's show, I did a little bit of a mailbag segment where I got some listener questions and I answered them myself. And these are some things that I'll probably touch base on with other handicappers and bettors here as we go throughout the weeks. But I do want to ask you something different that I got from at Jimmy Doomhands on Twitter, who sent me a couple of things to possibly use for the next mailbag segment. But I think that this one kind of classifies here for today's show. He's a pretty sharp guy, actually, from talking to him. He knows what he's doing here. He makes a lot of sense, gets a lot of closing line value. But what he wanted to know is, in terms of tracking purposes, and maybe we can look at it more in terms of a general sense, how do you define what a public play is? I mean, are you looking at, you know, the betting percentages out there in the market? And if it's, you know, X amount of bets are on this team, you know that that's the public side. How do you make that distinction? Do you have a definition for, you know, a public play versus a sharp play?
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't have a 100% clear-cut answer to that. But I use, I mean, thankfully, that what we've seen here in the last 3-4 years, you got sites like, you know, sportsinsights.com, you know, Scores and Odds. You can see public betting percentages. Now, I mean, volume on some of your Sun Belt games, I mean, I don't look, just because you got 90% on one side, I mean, heck, that could be, I mean, the volume could be so low. I mean, you're talking, you know, 10 bets or, you know, especially if it's early in the week. So, you know, what I like to look at is, you know, I don't even look at it too much early in the week. It's something I digest, you know, as the week goes on, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And if I see, you know, a big game in the SEC in college football and, you know, what I would define as a public play, you know, it is an overwhelming betting percentage on multiple sites. I just don't trust one individual source. You know, sometimes that overwhelming betting public percentage can move the line a point or two in college football, and you kind of get an idea. And plus, I mean, look, the books, the sports books are they're very candid. I mean, they'll tell you, all you got to do is ask the guys behind the counter, and they'll be quite frank with you and tell you, hey, you know, here's what the public's betting overwhelmingly. And a lot of times when people ask me, you know, how do you define what a sharp play is, or you know, what I like to call a pros versus Joes game, if you got an overwhelming amount of betting public percentages on one side, the line's moving in the opposite direction, that's a clear indication that the bigger money and most likely the sharper money is on the other side. So I don't have a clear-cut answer in that regard, but I think it's been a lot easier. I mean, sharp guys aren't necessarily the guys that are walking into a sports book with a trench coat and a top hat on anymore and, you know, open up a bag of money and throw it on the counter. That's not necessarily the case. I mean, you can identify a sharp as somebody that just got the absolute best line on a game for that particular week. Say you bet the opener, it was 2.5, and by the end of the week, the line ended up being, you know, 4 if you're betting a favorite. I mean, you got a sharp play there and a sharp, you understood where the line was going to go and you got a sharp bet there. So it's tough to identify it. Although I'll say this, I mean, I think it's a lot easier because of the internet. And I also, you know, give credit, I'm not a big fan of all the sportsbook guys, but, you know, they're not afraid. And you can read a lot of articles weekly at your various sites. I mean, they'll flat out tell you who the public's betting and who overwhelmingly the top betting public plays are for each and every week in the NFL and college football.
You know, I think guys aren't walking into sports books in trench coats because trench coat season in Las Vegas is only, what, maybe 6 weeks long? So I think
yeah, because yeah, 75 today. I was thinking, you know, after everything was done today as far as the handicapping and stuff, you know, I was thinking hot tub possibly for the first time in several months because, you know where I come from, Adam, and 75 degrees on February the 9th, I've never seen it in my entire life.
It was 60 degrees 2 days ago. Today it's snowing, and it's supposed to snow tomorrow too. So, hey, you know, rub it in a little bit more, why don't you? I do want to ask, before we get into a little bit more college basketball stuff, because there's a really important question I want to ask you that I'm also going to ask Ralph here later in the show, but are you contrarian in the NBA as well? Is that the you know, working theory that you subscribe to the most?
Yeah, absolutely.
Did I say NFL? Yeah, I meant to say NBA.
No, I mean, you did say NBA.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's probably stronger in the NBA than it is, college basketball. Obviously the betting handles a little bit more than an individual college basketball game. So I would say, yeah, contrarian, definitely more often than not. It's a tough market, though, and it's become increasingly tough when you have your guys, sitting. People sitting for Cleveland, you see 11-point line move there. It's tough, taking advantage of stuff, especially this time of the year. You got to wait a little bit, and almost you're at the mercy of waiting until, 3-4 hours before the game tips to get your final starting lineups. It's become, for me, and look, again, I'll say this, I'll compare my college football handicapping and football handicapping to anybody. But when it comes to basketball, I'm just not your world-class guy. I keep it it's the KISS method for me. I keep it real simple. I fade the public. I look for certain matchups, certain trends, and we just leave it as that. Obviously, when the college basketball season winds down, I go more deep dive as far as my NBA handicapping.
All right, well, let's get to the college side of things here, because I wanted to make sure I asked you this question, and this is something that I'll be crowdsourcing opinions on as we move forward here. But one of the big things I think about the college basketball season, and this can be pretty challenging, is you have massive, massive gaps between opponents. If you look at what some of these teams played in the non-conference, compare it to what they play in the conference, and also compare it to their marquee non-conference games, there are significant gaps. I mean, when you look at a league like the NBA, for example, I would say from a power rating standpoint, the biggest gap you'll have around this time of the year between two teams, maybe 15 or 16 points. In college basketball, it's going to be much, much greater than that. Almost like college football, where if Alabama was playing Texas State or something like that, you'd have probably a 40-point gap there in terms of a power rating number. So how do you eliminate that noise in college basketball? I mean, are you only looking at these 10 to 12 game conference play samples now? Do you add in those marquee games? Do you add in games against similar levels of talent? How do you do all of that in terms of putting together your numbers and putting together assessments of these college basketball teams?
Well, it's a great question. It's a complicated question because for starters, you want to look at the overall season stats. You want to look at recency bias, particularly conference stats only. And thankfully, you got a lot of great sites out there that just use conference stats only. When you talk about non-conference, you got to, it's real easy. KenPom.com. He does your strength of schedule, overall strength of schedule. And look, he's not the end all as far as that's the only ratings and your end all source. But he also breaks down the non-conference strength of schedule, and you can get some, like you mentioned, some varying differences between teams. I actually find more value when it comes tournament time. It's something that I look at it because you're not dealing with a lot of, the similar opponents. And so therefore I go right to the strength of schedule, particularly the non-conference strength of schedule for the two teams, because, particularly let's talk about a team like Gonzaga. Obviously the overall strength of schedule is not going to be there, but they did play teams like Florida, Arizona, away from home, so non-conference isn't going to be so bad. How do I, vary it? First off, I isolate, and really, it's tough to have an answer. Number one, as far as just regular board teams, you got 220 or 205, and you add another 140 added board teams. I particularly pinpoint specific conferences. I've seen to have more success in the ACC this year. I've kind of find my way, and I like the conferences that you don't have as big as gaps, to be honest with you. So I know all the information's out there in a conference like the ACC, but got to be honest with you, Adam, sometimes the betting public's getting more involved. And again, I'm a contrarian guy in some of the larger conferences, so sometimes you find some value there. And also it's just easier. And when you got a bunch of teams that are similar, it's almost like handicapping the NFL or the NBA. Your differences aren't that huge, and you can just go on and just, dive into specific matchups.
I guess my devil's advocate point then would be, and I guess we'll take a conference like the Mountain West, for example, which just had three games last night. UNLV got blown away. That was a game that you and I kind of talked about a little bit via DM yesterday. But in the Mountain West, you know, you have this league here where now Nevada 8-3, Boise State 8-3, Colorado State 8-4, New Mexico 8-5, bunch of teams 6-6 or 5-6. You have a clearly defined bottom with UNLV and Air Force. So I guess that would be an example of one of the leagues that you're talking about there where you don't have a lot of big gaps between teams. But that being said, also make the case you have a lot of inconsistency there because you have teams where they're just not all that good. So one game they may play above their ceiling, one game they may play below. I feel like that would be a little bit more challenging. So sort of set me in a different direction and maybe think differently if you can.
All right. Well, I mean, look, I mean, a league like the – sometimes, I mean, it's easier when you got – I mean, a league like that where you got you can throw a, you know, pick out of a hat as far as a conference like that. I mean, Nevada's probably the class of the league right now, and they are in my power ratings, not significantly above the other teams. But, you know, when they're evenly matching, you pick them out of a hat, that's when you go into your situational handicapping. I mean, are they playing back-to-back road games? Are they playing on short rest? I mean, sometimes, you get inconsistencies. Why? Well, I mean, some of it has to do with scheduling. Some of it has to do with particular matchups. So that's where, when you have inconsistencies, and you know, I'll go back to the ACC just for a little bit. I mean, a lot of it is just situational handicapping. When you got teams power rated similarly, when you got teams that are kind of in a rut, why are they in a rut? Maybe it's just scheduling purposes. So I find those sometimes easier. I know that you can't bank on a team to win 5-6 in a row, a specific team. You know, let's talk about the West Coast Conference. I think you got to clearly define 3-4 top teams, and you got, you know, everyone else. Obviously, Gonzaga head and shoulders above everyone else, but, you know, you throw St. Mary's, BYU, maybe San Francisco to a lesser extent, and then you got some very bad teams, Pepperdine, Portland, Pacific. Sometimes, if I had a clear, definite answer, you almost got to treat each and individual conference separately each and every season. That's what makes college basketball kind of a tougher handicap, in my opinion, especially in the regular season. To me, inconsistency could lead just because of particular scheduling patterns. That's a great question, and I don't know if I did it justice as far as with my answer, Adam.
No, it's fine. I mean, I think that it is really challenging, and that's why I think that the theme that we keep coming back to here is conference specialization, because if you want to try and handicap 351 teams, and like you said, 220 to 230 that are on the board all the time and then some that are added in there a little bit, it's really, really hard to do. And you know, we just talked about how there's college basketball in and of itself is a very high variance league. I mean, look at all the top 10, top 15, top 25 upsets we've had this year, and that'll give you a pretty good, you know, working example of how difficult it can be. So narrowing that focus probably is something that certainly works better. And like you said, you've had success in the ACC, so you keep going back to it. Because if you have success, it's pretty clear that you've got a good feel on a lot of the teams there in that league.
No doubt about it. And let's be honest. I mean, it's high variance, especially this time of the year. I mean, even your top teams. It's the end of January, early February. I mean, you can argue. I mean, college basketball regular season is not as important as your regular season in college football. I mean, teams are just hitting that point of the season where it's kind of a blah. Your legs are a little bit tired. I mean, you'd like to think that every game means everything to a lot of the kids, but the reality is for teams like Kentucky and Kansas, they're going to the NCAA tournament. They're going to be a top four seed. The games coming down in March are going to be – you get a lot less variance when it comes to March because, you know, it's winter go home for everybody. And to me, that's what makes, you know, believe it or not, even though the entire betting world's looking at those games, sometimes it's easier handicaps for me because you eliminate the variance. Every team is gunning for every game, and you don't have to question motivation more often than not. Yeah, I would say, you know, there's this 2-3 week period that we see every single season. Everyone says, it's parity in college basketball. I mean, it is to a certain extent, but it also is, I mean, you're playing 30, 35 game seasons now for a lot of teams in the regular season. Now it's just, we see the professionals hit that wall, and we see it every single year, and at least since I've been following the last 10, 15 years for a majority of teams. It's just that time of the year. It's the conference grind, and not a lot of teams are equipped to handle it by winning, continuing to win, and avoiding the upsets.
Well, a lot of good assessments here today from Brad Powers at BradPowersSports.com. We'll keep working on these things here as we get closer to March Madness, keep going through some of the nuts and bolts of college basketball, and also, Brad, we'll try to work in some more NBA next week as well. I want to make sure that we're throwing a bone to the fans of the association. But what's going on over at BradPowersSports.com right now?
Yeah, BradPowerSports.com. I'll tell you what, this upcoming weekend I will be throwing, you know me, I'm college football. I'll be throwing my college football recruiting rankings on there. We're also, diving into college basketball each and every day. It's a grind now through the next couple of months. You can purchase those VIP services if you're interested. If you're a football guy and just looking for a weekly newsletter, we've had tremendous success with it each of the last 2 years. You can still take advantage of the price. The lowest price you see all season, $79 for the newsletter. Very proud to say that two-year record combined, hundreds of plays and hitting 57%. Again, that's not too shabby. I know it's not marketing the 70, 80, 90% short-term winning percentage, but I'll take 57% over a two-year window on every single college and NFL pick. Again, that's the Powers Picks newsletter that you can pick up for $79. And again, I'll have more and more football and basketball information as we move along throughout the course of the season. Also, you can follow me on Twitter at Brad Powers, #7.
Before I let you go, I'm going to put you on the spot, because when I talked yesterday in the mailbag, I talked about how, the reason that I do this show, the reason that I do the format that I do, is because I want people to be able to do a lot of their own handicapping and betting. I want to give people the tools that they need to succeed, which I know a lot of other shows just throw out a ton of free picks and, you know, people just stand on a soapbox and scream as loud as they can about those short-term streaks that you just referenced. So let's go ahead and throw a bone, though, to our listeners that are in search of that. You got a free pick for tonight off the top of your head?
Oh, I love it. Yeah, let's go to the West Coast. San Francisco, game number 7-6-6 tonight. Let's lay it and play it with the Dons -4.5. It's just a team that I don't think's been power rated accordingly here the last couple of games. In fact, if you're looking at them, as far as tonight's game, I got a power rated closer to 8. I think the gentleman you're going to have, I'm going to throw a bone to him. I mean, he just cashed his top college basketball play of the entire season last weekend on him. It's a team that's covered 8 of their last 9 games. I like the situation because they're playing their third home game out of 4 straight. Meanwhile, their opponent tonight, Santa Clara, is on the road for a third consecutive game. San Francisco's playing with revenge, inside out, handicap in that game against Santa Clara earlier this season. I mean, you look at San Francisco only shot, 5 out of 23 from three-point range. Meanwhile, Santa Clara hit 50%, 13 out of 26 from three-point range. San Francisco's got the better defense, like the situation. Think there's line value there. Give me San Francisco -4.5 tonight.
Love it. There you go. Great way to wrap up today's segment with Brad Powers, again from BradPowersSports.com. Brad, thank you so much for your time, man. Really appreciate it. We'll talk to you again next week, bud.
All right. Sounds good. Take care, my friend.
Great segment there with Brad Powers at BradPowersSports.com. I'm going to go ahead and throw this out there for you. If you do want to back that San Francisco play there tonight that Brad threw out there, head on over to DSI Sportsbook, where our Bang the Book Radio listeners can use the promo code BTB Radio. That'll get you a $10 free bet simply for signing up, just to test drive out the site, make sure that you like what's going on. Then they'll give you an additional 50 to 100% deposit bonus based on the amount of your initial deposits. Maybe take that $10 and go ahead and throw it on San Francisco tonight and start building your bankroll over there at DSI Sportsbook. We've got another professional handicapper coming out of the broadcast here. That is Mr. Ralph Michaels of WagerTalk.com. Ralph, how's it going today, man?
Great, Adam. Thank you for having me on. Super Bowl's over. We can start focusing solely on hoops.
That's right. The Super Bowl is over, and before you and I start focusing solely on hoops, how did Super Bowl 51 go for you?
You know what? Not the way I thought. I like New England and the under. A lot of my props were based on that. And then with Atlanta getting out to the, to the quick lead, it changed the perception of the game, the way Brady had to throw. When you run 45 plays for Atlanta and some of your props were based on some of those receivers getting yards, it was a little under 500 for me on my props. But again, it is Super Bowl. It's a day to have fun. It's a day to enjoy. And it's a day to eat and drink too much.
Well, did you at least win doing that?
I did. Thank you.
Good. All right. Perfect. That's exactly what I did. I ate way too much and drank way too much. And I feel like the Super Bowl hangover is probably still continuing a little bit here into Thursday, but we'll put that in the rearview mirror. Let's talk some college basketball here, Ralph. We got plenty of things to talk about. Had a listener question yesterday when I did my mailbag segment about buying points and whether or not it's profitable. And of course, the examples I used where it can be profitable are around some of those key numbers in the NFL and in college, 3 and 7, you know, buying the 7.5, buying, you know, down to 6.5, that type of thing. Is that ever a strategy that you would recommend in college basketball?
It is not. I mean, you know, it's something you got to remember. Vegas puts out opportunities for gamblers because it puts them in a better position to win money. While it's frustrating to lose a game by a point or a half a point, you got to look at it. And if our listeners that are interested in buying a point, every time they thought about buying a point, put in a dollar and see how much you have at the end of the year. I think you're much better off. There's such a variance. And again, it's easy to say, well, look how sharp these lines are for the 4, 5, 6 games that fall right at the number. But in the scope of things, Vegas invents games and extra bets to make more money. So therefore the odds are not there.
Yeah, and like you said, I mean, college basketball being the high variance sport that it is, also I think in a general sense, and this probably goes over to the NBA as well, I'm not going to say that it's never profitable because I'm sure mathematically there are places where it's profitable, but you know, with scoring done in ones and twos as opposed to threes and sixes and sevens like it is in football, it just seems to me like, you know, buying a half point here and there, even though the scoring increments are smaller, it just seems like it, I don't know, for whatever reason, it just seems like it's not a great idea. And it may be backed up by math. To be honest with you, I haven't run it completely. But it just does seem like basketball is a much more high variance sport than football.
Well, in college or in the NFL, you may have 7 scores a team. In an NBA game, you have 50 scores per team. So the ratio is just not there. If you're looking at a per score basis, you know, it's not the same thing because in football, you may be thinking, well, that team is going to score one time less, and perhaps that'll get you at your number. In basketball, one time less won't affect the score.
Well, along those same lines, then, we talk about teasers on the football side where you tease through 3, 4, 6, and 7. If you've got a 2-point dog, you suddenly get them +8. You add a lot of value there because you're picking up key numbers. So along the same lines, do you believe that college basketball teasers have some value, or is that just a similar thing where there's simply too much variance to put a lot of stake in that?
I don't. You know, we've seen I'm an anti-teaser in hoops altogether. Now, in the NFL and college, teasers can be profitable. You know, again, let me just relate it back. When you have a teaser and the total's in the high 30, and you're getting a 6-point teaser, you're getting 16% of the total score to be able to tease and put it where you want. In basketball, you're getting 4 points on a total in the NBA that's 100, or in a college that's, you know, 100 per team, and in a college that's 70 per team, you're only getting to tease, you know, 4% versus the difference in football. So again, in football, fewer scores, a much higher percentage of the total value. Basketball gets diluted.
Well, and another thing that I always preach to our listeners, and I just want to mention this again because it's a good time to bring it up, much like I did yesterday. If you're worried about a half point or a point here or there, if you've got multiple sports books at your disposal, you probably would have been able to get that target line that you're looking for so long as you shopped around. So really, you know, that's the best course of action for people to take.
Yeah, and you would be surprised. People may think that astute gamblers only shop at 1, 2, or 3 books. Friends of mine and people that you know as well, these people have 12, 15 outs, and that is their job, is to watch that screen, to watch those line moves, to see when they play games. And that's why they're successful at what they do, is because that 1 point can make a difference. The different side of a professional gambler doing that is not, he's not paying that extra cent to get that 1 point that people want to pay when they're buying a point. He's getting it because of hard work and time invested.
And that is the really important thing. And that's why we talk so much about stuff like market entry here on the show, because you know, you want to make sure, especially in games like basketball, where, you know, maybe if you miss a number in the NFL or college, it's not as big of a deal. But if you start missing games in college basketball, you know, where the numbers tend to fall pretty close to the line, and you know, you have situations where a half point could make a really significant difference because there are different fall numbers in basketball, you know, then you want to make sure that you are putting yourself in a position to have the most success by getting the best number that you possibly can. Ralph, I want to ask you something else here. You know, we talk a lot about situational handicapping. We've discussed that a lot here on these segments, and of course, we'll continue to discuss that. But we've done it a lot with regards to sides. Do you use situational angles to play totals as well? And if so, what are you looking for in that respect?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's even more important. You know, in the college basketball guide, you've been kind enough to mention it a few times. I include over-unders for all five categories, line games, homes, away, favorites, and dogs. And the reason is this. Teams play differently as a favorite or as a dog. You want to look at a normal pace of a team. Are they a fast-paced team? Are they a slow-paced team? And when you're handicapping, I always look at the home team and the favorite. If a team is a home favorite, I play the game out in my head thinking that they're going to be able to control the pace they want. So it could be very different when Florida State travels to North Carolina compared to when Florida State travels to Louisville. If the opponent is going to be able to control the pace of the game, it's very important to look at situational handicapping with totals. That's one thing where I never look at an overall record for over-unders for the year, because the home and away and the favorite and the dogs are such a variance. Again, that's a situation where it's more important when you're looking at totals to see a road scoring average and a home scoring average, and then I also break it down into favorite and dog.
You know, I think it's really interesting. We kind of have an example of a game tonight, and this is obviously a very, very big game on the slate this evening. So it's interesting to talk about this total. Duke and North Carolina. Now, both of these teams can light up the scoreboard. The difference is North Carolina is like a top 35 team in pace. Duke's kind of around average. I think they're 130th or something like that. There's a total that opened 162.5. TV game, highly public game. Not a big surprise to see that total open a little bit higher. And you think about Duke and North Carolina matchups, and you think about all the talent and athleticism on the floor, and the sharp side in this game was to push the total down. And I think part of that would have to do with the fact that, like you were just talking about, Duke plays at a little bit slower of a pace. You like to think that the home team, as a slight favorite here, can dictate the pace of this game.
And you have to remember that, you know, Duke is not the same Duke team with Coach K having missed seven games. You know, with Grayson Allen was supposed to be their go-to guy. And, you know, with all the surface atmosphere surrounding him, he hasn't been the go-to guy. But this is a game where you have two teams that are familiar with each other. You have two teams with state pride on the line. You know, last year both games went under the total. Last year the totals were 160.5 and 163.5. North Carolina won the first game 76-72 and won the second. Duke won the second game 74-73. So both games were in the 148 total with totals in the 160, much like tonight. You have familiarity. You have a close game, which means you don't have those runaways. You know, a lot of times teams go on spurts and press and go on those 10-0 runs and the other teams come back. This is sort of that championship fight where guys stand toe-to-toe and you don't get those 10-0, 12-0 spurts that you do in some games to push up the scores. So anytime I have two fierce rivals, legitimate rivals like this, I always tend to look at the under first.
Well, that's a good thing because I had a listener ask yesterday about, you know, what my process is, what my routine is for coming to deciding if I want to make a game a play, and sort of asked, you know, if there was a little bit of a gut feeling to it. And I think that plays into it, what you were just talking about. It's like anything else. There's no substitute for experience. You know, you can have all these models, you can have all the analytics, and obviously they work for a lot of people, and I won't talk them down because they work for me in various sports. But also, you know, you have that intuition, you have that working knowledge of remembering how things have gone in the past, and it's never a bad thing to really factor that heavily in your handicapping, I don't think.
You know, and again, you got to remember, this is a public game. This is one of the few public college basketball games that the entire country knows of. Duke, North Carolina is it in college hoops. And Vegas bases a line to get equal money on both sides of the play. So, again, public's going to take, you know, in this game, there is no public team between North Carolina and Duke, but public's going to want to play the over. Therefore, the line is adjusted. And again, this isn't anything new, but I talk to customers often that are just getting into sports betting, and why is this line off? Well, the line is off because Vegas puts a line to get equal money on both sides. They do not put a line out to where the line should be. We've seen the Notre Dame anomaly in the 90s. We saw the Cowboys anomalies. We see the Patriots anomaly. Now, the Patriots are one of the teams that kept, you know, besides getting that extra point or two, they kept covering, so it doesn't always work. But that's why sharps tend to look at the dog and the under, because lines are usually inflated a half to 1 to 1.5 points to the favorite and the over to get equal money on both sides of action on a game.
We'll move on to the next talking point here that I wanted to discuss after I went off on a little bit of a tangent there using an example for tonight's game. But one of the things I want to talk about is eliminating noise in college basketball, because there's a lot of it. Like I was talking about with Brad, you know, you have some really, really enormous gaps between teams, particularly during the non-conference portion of the season. Those are factored into the full season numbers for these teams. So if you're doing a side-by-side comparison, if you're looking at points per game or field goal percentage or, you know, whatever the case may be, you have to keep in mind that some of those numbers are probably inflated because they played D2 or D3 schools in the preseason, or maybe they played, you know, a Big West team as a Pac-12 team, some kind of thing like that. What do you do to eliminate that noise in college basketball so that you can get a truer reflection of what these teams are at this time of the year?
Well, I use that, and I adjust my numbers accordingly. You know, if you're going to look at the college basketball guide I produce, and I don't want to keep mentioning it, but I have an adjusted offensive and defensive number. You know, let's take a quick look here. On the season, games through Monday, Houston was averaging 75 points per game, and they played a strength of schedule of 103. Memphis played a weaker schedule, but they're averaging 76 points per game, a full 1.2 points per game better. But you compare them to the defenses they played, I have Houston as my number 33 adjusted offense and Memphis 123, a difference of 90 despite Memphis being the higher scoring team. So you're taking away that noise, as you mentioned. You're taking away those non-conference games where Memphis was scoring 80 and 90, pressing the pace, trying to get a lot of people to play. When you get into conference action, that pace gets slowed down. The offense becomes more inefficient. And despite averaging more points, they're 90 spots less in my adjusted offense.
What are you using for that? Are you using like effective field goal percentage, points per possession? What sort of goes into your formula?
Yes, it's a lot of it is the average opponent defense that you face. That's the biggest number. Then it gets adjusted by the adjusted field goal percentage, by the numbers of 2 and 3 point shots. And I also look at offensive rebounds because, a team that has is very strong on offensive rebounds will always shoot the ball better because, we'll always have that percentage that is at 50% perhaps. But if a team's taking two shots and shooting 50% and one team shooting three-pointers and not getting the rebounds, it adjusts the number. So all of those go to a formula. But the biggest thing I look at is the average defense faced for that opponent.
All right, well, that makes a whole lot of sense. I mean, we kind of talked about this as well, that, you know, defense travels. So you do want to look for those teams that, you know, generally you kind of want to slant a little bit, I would think, towards defense because, you know, we talk about it all the time. There's different shooting backdrops. There's much different elevations in some of these conferences. It can be a lot more challenging to go out on the road and shoot. But theoretically speaking, you should play defense no matter where you are. So that's definitely something for our listeners to take to heart there, is make sure that you are adjusting those numbers based on, you know, the opposition that has been faced, because, you know, in conference play, the gaps between these teams quite a bit smaller. This is a really, really great point you brought up. You sent this over to me just before the show, and I'm glad you brought this up. I wish it was something I would have thought of. The pressure on mid-major teams here at this time of the year, because at-large berths are really hard to come by for the NCAA tournament. A lot of these teams are going to have to win their conference tournament to make sure that they get a spot in the big dance. And you've isolated five teams here that you're really paying close attention to, beginning with a couple in the Missouri Valley.
Well, you know, last year, this has changed. Now, again, you got to remember, the committee is a live organism. It changes, you know, year in and year out. You know, it's just a bigger college football playoff committee. What happens? You know, wow, Ohio State did not win the Big Ten championship. Why are they in? I thought that was your main preface. Well, you know, first it comes down to wins, and then they make adjustments. College basketball is the same thing. It changes every year. They look at KenPom numbers. They look at Sagarin numbers. Sometimes they weigh one category more than others. But last year it came down to, despite SMU and Louisville deciding not to go into the tournament, Wichita State was the only at-large team. They were 24-8. They lost to Northern Iowa in the second round of the Missouri Valley Conference, and Wichita State, because of their name and because of getting 24 wins, were now in. Now, in the Missouri this year, you know, Wichita is 21-4, Illinois State 19-5, and Illinois State's loss last week to Wichita, a loss would have been okay. A 40-point loss is really going to hurt them. I have Illinois State as my 55th team. They're clearly in jeopardy, but they're still within range where if they can run the table and perhaps get to the Missouri Valley Conference championship, I think they have a shot to make it. Instance, this past Tuesday, they played Bradley. They were a 7.5-point favorite. They won that game 82-53. They know they have pressure on them. They're a team good enough that I'll actually look to play on, and they will try to extend that score and get some meaningful big wins to impress the committee. So Illinois State is a play-on team for me, despite having that pressure. You know, we look to CUSA. Middle Tennessee is my 60th team. They're probably out. They, you know, they're 20-4. Now they host Old Dominion on Thursday. I'll look to play on them. One thing Middle has for them is they beat Tennessee and they already beat Mississippi this year. So they have a couple of wins. They're in that 60 range. You really need to be within the 45 range or higher to get mentioned. A huge game this weekend, you know, the biggest mid-major game there is, besides when Wichita plays Illinois State, is St. Mary's and Gonzaga. Remember last year St. Mary's got left off. People thought it was a travesty. What happened? They lost to Gonzaga in the finals in the Big West. Well, they host Portland tonight, and while I would normally look to play on them, now, because they have pressure to win, because they're hosting Gonzaga on Saturday, that's a situation that I'm going to look past tonight because everything is that Gonzaga game. If they get crushed against Gonzaga at home, I'm going to say they're going to be out as well. And then one more team I want to mention is NC Wilmington. They're my number 58 team right now. They're 21-4, so they can get to 27-4. If they do that and they get to the finals, they're a team I think that has a shot to be one of those rare at-large mid-majors again this year. So while I'm going to say the better team I want to look to play on them, there's situations like St. Mary's against Portland where I'm not going to put that thought into play because of Gonzaga on deck.
And I think another interesting thing to mention here is if you're St. Mary's, and tonight they're a 23-point favorite against Portland, so they're going to win that game. It's really a matter of by how many points they actually do. If they go and lose to Gonzaga again here on Saturday, what happens to them in their final four conference games here before the conference tournament? Because at that point, they're fully aware that the only way they get into the big dance is by winning the West Coast Conference. So what kind of effort do you get against Loyola Marymount or on the road at BYU, at Pepperdine, at home against Santa Clara? That's something that's another interesting thing to watch here as we get deeper into February is you have a lot of teams that come to the realization of, look, our season comes down to the three or four games we play in our conference tournament.
It is. And, you know, this is brand new for St. Mary's because last year they found out they weren't good enough to make it. So this isn't something we can go back and look at history because it occurred for the first time last year. I'm not going to pretend I know what's in the player's head and what's in the coach's head. What I'll likely do is see what they did against Gonzaga, win or lose. It's going to be an emotional week the following week, either way, off a win or off a loss. But I'll look to see how they reacted the first game and then play accordingly. So just because we know the situation, we know it's going to be emotional, we know it's going to be a letdown, you know, or perhaps they're so high, play as well, that I'm going to wait to see what happens, have it marked, mark my schedule ahead, take a look at that second game, see what they did in the first, and adjust my numbers accordingly.
Ralph, in a general sense, I mean, you know, I know that situational handicapping is really the foundation of what you do in college basketball. Is this the strongest time of the year for you? Because I feel like we get a lot more situational spots middle of February, late February, because the grueling travel schedule is starting to wear some teams down a little bit, especially those teams that may be younger and have a lot of freshmen that are just coming off of, you know, playing the high school seasons. You've got this pressure at the mid-major level. You've got the really good teams that are playing marquee games that people are paying more attention to. Then they go on the road and play like a middle of the road type team in their conference. Do you find that, you know, you draw a lot more spots and maybe have a little bit higher of a volume here as we go over the next, 2.5 weeks of February?
I do. While you find the numbers tighter, basically, you know, if you're going to make your numbers, you're going to find that you're within 2 to 3 points of every number on the board. Okay, again, it's not rocket science to make numbers. And what you got to look for are those situational differences. Now, I'm going to carry this on. I caught the end of your and Brad's show, and you talked about some of the teams, and they're so mixed in some conferences. You guys mentioned the Mountain West. One thing I looked at, and it's very important come February and the last quarter of the regular season, I look at coaches that are on their way out for teams that are losing, and I look at coaches in the first year for teams that are losing. As a first-year head coach, and I'm coming in and I'm changing systems, I can rally my kids and say, hey, listen, let's finish strong. This means something. Let's take this into the tournament. Even if we don't do well in the tournament, it's a building block for next year. When I have a third or fourth-year head coach, and for the third or fourth year, I'm in single-digit wins come February, and I know this coach isn't going to be around, it's much harder for me as a head coach to motivate those kids to go on the road and play against a better team when you're down at halftime and try to come back in the second half. So something we haven't mentioned, I am a very strong proponent on positive first-year head coaches when it comes to this time to be able to help motivate your kids.
I want to make sure I mention this since we talked a little bit about the Mountain West again. Had a listener reach out to both of us on Twitter last week after our segment at TCFly2 and mentioned that as of February 3rd, Mountain West home teams had a 63% win percentage straight up, which was the eighth best of all the conferences, and mentioned that the high road ATS winning percentage but relatively low straight up percentage showed that Vegas may be making too much of a home team point spread adjustment because, you know, obviously there are travel spots, there's altitude, all that type of thing. So great point by our listener, Craig, out there. I want to make sure I gave that a shout out on the show here. But all of these things just have to be factors for you in your day-to-day college basketball handicapping. And the nice thing is, like we've talked about, and Ralph, I know you've referenced this before, you know which days these conferences are playing on. So if you want to specialize in them, you know, you're going to be caught off guard with when these teams are playing.
It is. And, you know, as we mentioned, the Mountain West, you know, we mentioned this a couple shows ago. My number one team in the Mountain West is Nevada. They're my number 67th team. The worst team, who they played last night was UNLV, is number 211. So you only have a 140 swing from top to bottom. That's the closest of all the conferences. So when you have teams that are evenly matched, that play each other all the time, that, you know, the largest margin, I'm looking at year-to-date stats. Nevada is the team plus 6.9 points per game. That's on the entire year. UNLV on the entire year is minus 3.6 points per game. So top to bottom, not only do you only have a 130 difference in my rankings, you only have a 10.5 difference in points per game scoring for the entire season. That tells you how evenly matched they are.
All right, let's get into your situational and technical games of the week here, so long as you want to share those with our listeners. In looking at what happened last night, I kind of have a sneaking suspicion that your situational play may come from the Mountain West, but if it doesn't, this is still a situation that we're going to talk about after that.
Well, now we're going to start Adam's situational play of the week, because I'm not. I'm going to the ACC. We talked about Duke and North Carolina tonight. You know, Duke was 4-3 without Coach K after his back surgery. And first game back against Pittsburgh, they struggled in the first half. I think they were tied at 24, and they pulled away in the second half, but they didn't cover. They host North Carolina tonight on Thursday. Next Tuesday, they travel to number 12, Virginia. Virginia is my new number one defensive team in the country with their performance of late. And Duke plays Clemson in between. Clemson off a one-point loss. Clemson has three wins in the ACC. Duke's going to be about a 12-point favorite. I think they look past Clemson. I'm going to take Clemson plus the points, and you can't expect Duke to be up after getting Coach K back, after hosting North Carolina, and next week going to Virginia. Clemson's the flat spot in my situational play of the week.
You know, I think something I like about that, too, is that Clemson had some extra time to get over that buzzer beater loss to Syracuse the other night. So, you know, it's not like they're playing Thursday, Saturday coming off of a tough loss. They actually played that game a couple days ago. So that is something I'm looking
exactly.
at.
Two extra days rest. They're 5-3 as a dog. You know, you don't get up for a 3-win ACC team. But again, they had a couple close games. They could easily be a 500 ACC team. But, you know, a 3-win ACC team is better than 200 other of our Division I basketball teams.
All right, the situational play that I was looking at here, and we'll see if this one comes to fruition, and also we'll see what kind of number we're looking at here. But Colorado State hosts Fresno State Saturday afternoon. It's a 2 o'clock local time tip, 4 o'clock Eastern time. Fresno State just played 4 overtimes last night in Wyoming, which is the highest elevation for a Division I team, at least for football. I don't know if it is for basketball as well. But you've got the back-to-back in-altitude doubleheader, and you just played 4 overtimes on Wednesday night. That will be built into the line. Colorado State will be a little bit of an inflated favorite, but it's hard to find a worse spot for that for a team, especially a Fresno State team that's actually been pretty decent this year.
Well, you know, Fresno is a team that you know, last night you were getting 2 or 1.5, so Fresno either lost by a hook or pushed. Fresno is 7-0 going into last night's game as a dog. They're a team that I had underrated. They're a team that continues to cash on the road. They're a young team, and they've learned to play together, and they're a team that doesn't give up. You know, in that game, you know, without putting in the double overtime effect, I have Colorado State a point and a half better, plus the home edge, so maybe 6. You know, you may be laying 7 because of that. But, again, I just mentioned that Fresno is an incredible underdog this year, but I do like your spot very much.
Well, and the fact that they're a pretty good underdog, I mean, that's, in theory, something the odds makers should have been paying attention to, right? And, obviously, I think given the line in Wyoming last night, even though there's not a huge gap between those two teams, I think that that does imply they are getting some road respect for that now 7-1 record.
They are. I actually have Fresno 1.7 points better. So, you know, with 1.7, and you figure an average 4.5 home edge in college, you know, I tweaked that accordingly. You know, Wyoming would have been laying 2.8, and they were laying 2 when it went down to 1. So, they clearly are giving a point because of that 7-0 ATS run.
All right. Well, let's move on to your technical game of the week here then. And look, I mean, the situational stuff is fantastic. And, you know, that's a definite strength of yours. But also, I really like these technical plays that you've been coming up with here as well. I think there's a lot of credence to them, and I'm excited to hear what this week's is.
Well, we talked about this game a few shows back. And now I don't want listeners to get carried away with this title, but it's going to be the technical game of the year. This is the one situation where we have best against worst. We're going to the Mount Rushmore State, the Summit League. South Dakota State plays at South Dakota. The South Dakota Coyotes 9-1 against the spread at home, 8-1 against the spread as a favorite. The South Dakota State Jackrabbits, 3-9 ATS on the road, 3-11 ATS as a dog. That means when the home team plays in the South Dakota and South Dakota State games, the home team is 18-4 against the spread. The dog or favorite in those South Dakota, South Dakota State games, 19-4 against the spread. Going to be laying about 7 or 8. It's held true. It held true again this past Tuesday and Wednesday. I played against South Dakota State last night against North Dakota State. South Dakota also won on the road. So, again, it is just a technical play, but clearly I think it'll be the best situation we see the entire year from positive ATS numbers and negative ATS numbers.
A lot of excellent thoughts here today from Ralph Michaels of WagerTalk.com. Ralph, what's going on over there at the website right now?
You know what? We're just kicking away, having a good week. It's plays, daily plays available at WagerTalk.com. I did put a special up, basically 2 months for the price of one. You can get it at WagerTalk or emailing me at CalSports at AOL. $279 gets you from now through Monday night, April the 3rd. Takes you through all the college tournaments, all the extra NIT, CBA, CTI tournaments, and any NBA plays included in that group. And at CalSportsLV is the Twitter.
And make sure you check out Rolf's college basketball guide. That's a really fantastic resource for you as well. But, Ralph, thank you so much for your time, man. Really appreciate it. We'll talk to you again next week.
Adam, thank you.
Good stuff there. Great college basketball segments here on today's show. We've got one more segment left to go. We'll go into the Octagon for this one. We'll bring on Jay Primetown of MMAOddsBreaker.com. Jay, how's it going today, man?
Yeah, glad to be back. Definitely have a significant blizzard out in the Northeast. So a lot of people are out of work today, myself included. And, you know, that ties into this week's UFC in Brooklyn. So I guess, you know, that unexpected snowstorm, you know, could affect some fighters' preparation for Saturday's card.
Well, congratulations on the adult snow day. That's a rarity.
Yeah, that's I guess that's the plus of working in the suburbs. You know, if you get a foot of snow, it makes it hard to drive to work. So it is what it is. And I'm enjoying, you know, a relaxing Thursday.
Well, that is a really interesting thing here. Now, I presume most of the combatants here for this weekend would have already been in town or may have adjusted their travel plans based on the fact that the weather was coming. So do you feel like that has any sort of impact on handicapping this event?
I don't know. I hadn't really thought about it much until, you know, I just said it. But, I mean, I guess to look at it one way, the weigh-ins are tomorrow. You know, I guess most fighters, you know, tend to run inside or, you know, do different preparations, use sauna to lose the necessary weight to make the weight. But, you know, some people do like to run outside and, you know, move around and, you know, even just like going to the, you know, the supermarket to get the type of food that they want, that type of thing, from, you know, more healthier type of stores. And, you know, most people don't want to be outside in the middle of a snowstorm like that. So it's an interesting dynamic. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure all the fighters have already been here. They had to be here a couple of days ago. So it's, I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting dynamic, to say the least. I don't really have any sort of, you know, inkling on any particular fighters being affected. But, you know, I'll definitely be keeping an eye just if I hear anything over the next couple of days.
Well, and some of these fighters probably haven't seen snowfall like this. So not that it's going to affect anything, but you know, it's still going to be a little bit of a different feel for them and maybe throw them potentially out of their element a little bit. I don't know. Who knows? Maybe we're just kind of reaching here a little bit with that. But before we dig into some of these specific matchups here for this UFC 208 card, and again, this one at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn on pay-per-view, your overall impressions of the card, Jay?
Yeah, certainly not the best pay-per-view they've ever done. You know, it's the first pay-per-view the UFC has done in 2017. I think it's the latest the UFC has done their first pay-per-view in a year, and I think 6 or 7 years. Usually there's one Super Bowl weekend, sometimes even earlier than that. But, so this is a little later. You know, it's weird that there's a title fight for a division that hasn't existed before as the main event, but they did bring in Anderson Silva, so that's always going to be a marquee attraction, considering his status, you know, as a legend in this sport. And then there's obviously some other Brazilians on his card, you know, that are fairly well known. So there's definitely a significant Brazilian flavor to this event. And I think from, you know, from an action standpoint, it'll probably be better than the card written on paper. So I'm going to say better than what's being advertised.
All right, well, we've actually got a pretty interesting fight here in the main event because this is a new division, the women's featherweight division. This is the inaugural championship fight. Holly Holm now an underdog here in this one, paying back about even money at DSI Sportsbook.
Yeah, that is interesting. You know, when this fight was first announced, I expected Holm to be, you know, a fairly sizable favorite, just based on name notoriety in general. I was kind of surprised at the way it was lined and then the way that it's moved now that Holm's the underdog. You know, with that said, both these fighters were bantamweight fighters, 135 pounds, and now they're moving up a weight to fight at a division that doesn't exist. There's no other fighters on the roster besides Cyborg, who's suspended, who are actually in this division. So it's really a two, three fighter division at this point. I guess they'll be bringing in fighters, or maybe there'll be a couple of bantamweights that move up to featherweight. So it's a little different than some of the other divisions where they already had a built-in, you know, roster of sorts. So that's an interesting dynamic. And as for the fight, it's interesting because, you know, in Holly Holm's, you know, last fight, she fought, you know, a striker, a well-rounded striker in Shevchenko, and really struggled. You know, Holly Holm's a really good boxer. And then, you know, she fought someone who is well-rounded in terms of strikes, and not just punches, but kicks and elbows and just a lot more variety. And she's doing that again here. So that makes it really interesting. Because I think it could be very similar to her last fight where she's going to struggle against a fighter that just has a much more well-rounded striking skill set. Does go to the ground. I mean, I think Holly Holm probably actually has an advantage over Jermaine Durandamay, but I don't think it's going to spend much time on the ground. I've heard a lot of people on Holly Holm, and I think it's more because of the name value, and they don't really think Jermaine Durandamay is, like, up to par because she's not really an MMA fighter. She's more of a striker. But in this fight, she's really going to be mainly striking. I don't see this being, you know, an MMA fight where there's going to be all these different facets of MMA being exercised. Is going to be a striking exchange, and I think Jermaine Durandamay is going to win the fight, and she's going to, you know, just out kind of class, just like Holly Holm's last fight against Shevchenko, just kind of get beaten up by a more well-rounded striker that has more, you know, tools in her toolbox. So I think Durandamay wins this fight probably by decision, but you know, we shall see. I was, like I said before, I was hoping for a better line on the Durandamay based on just the notoriety that Holm has for finishing Ronda Rousey. But it's not there. She's the favorite, so I'm going to pass.
All right, well, let's talk about the middleweight fight here between the aforementioned Anderson Silva. He takes on Derek Brunson. Brunson, a -140 favorite here in this fight. Is this a true price, or is this price down a little bit because of the name recognition of a guy like Anderson Silva?
Yeah, probably is a bit down. That said, you know, again, you kind of look back to the last fight that Derek Brunson was in. He faced, you know, a striker in Robert Whittaker, and Brunson ran at him kind of like a madman and got caught coming in multiple times and was eventually finished. The one thing about Anderson Silva, sure, he's not the same fighter he was 3, 4, 5 years ago, but he's still arguably the greatest counter-striker in the history of mixed martial arts. If Brunson comes, you know, if Brunson, you know, is aggressive like he was in the Whittaker fight, he is very capable of being finished by Anderson Silva. Just, you know, Anderson's, you know, is kind of a sniper in that regard. He'll easily be able to land if he has a fighter coming in without, you know, really any semblance of strategy or striking defense. So I think Anderson by TKO is a very real possibility here at, you know, well, they're not the KO lines out yet, but Anderson Silva inside the distance line is +230. I think that's a very real possibility. But at the same time, if Brunson doesn't act like a wild man like that, he has a big wrestling advantage. Anderson's been taken down in recent fights, just when he fought Daniel Cormier last summer. He really didn't have any chance to muster much of an offense because he was taken down and, you know, laid on top of for the majority of the fight. That could happen here as well. So definitely see a Brunson by decision or an Anderson Silva by TKO line. And just because of the numbers, I think Anderson Silva by TKO when it comes out. Like I said, plus 230 is inside the distance, but once the TKO line is out, probably be, I don't know, closer to plus 300. I think that's, you know, an interesting number, you know, given the two likely outcomes of this bout.
So is this maybe an arbitrage spot where you look to maybe go Brunson minus 140 and then take that bigger price on Silva, either in the distance or the TKO prop when that comes out?
Yeah, I like that. That's a pretty good idea. I hadn't really thought about the Brunson. I was thinking more of the Brunson decision, which is plus 300, with the Silva inside the distance plus 230. But Brunson could potentially finish as well because Anderson Silva's chin isn't what it used to be either. So, yeah, Brunson minus 140 and then Anderson Silva by TKO is a pretty good opportunity for sure. I think that's a very likely winner, actually.
Do you do a lot of ARB when it comes to UFC? I know we've talked about this in the past. Is it something you've incorporated a little bit more, or are there just not the right set of circumstances a lot of the times?
Yeah, sometimes the numbers just don't match. I think in this case they do. I'm more of the inkling with fights where you can get one line a couple days before, and then on fight day the line balloons to another number, and you can just pick off, you know, 20, 30, 40 cents and just, you know, call it a day and make your profit and move on. Because, you know, those opportunities do exist in MMA where the lines do fluctuate. You can sometimes see a fighter who's, you know, a plus 120 underdog and all of a sudden is a minus 160 favorite on fight day, something like that. And there's an opportunity in the middle. So those opportunities I do more than to play both sides. But, you know, just as we're talking here, I think that the Brunson money line and Anderson inside the distance is a really good opportunity, and that's a winner.
You know, I think I remember, too, with some of the recent events that you've talked about on Twitter, and our listeners can follow Jay on Twitter at JayPrimetown. I believe you've talked a little bit more about live betting here with some of these recent events as well, where you feel like you're getting some better options, and certainly you've talked about them here on the show as well, but you know, looking at live betting, say, after the first round, whether it's to sort of limit your risk a little bit, you know, or maybe catch a fighter that got off to a slow start at a better price, some kind of thing like that.
Yeah, that's certainly possible as well. And sometimes it's even a worse line. You know, there could be a fighter who is maybe even money. There was a pick-em fight, and then after the first round, you might see something like a minus 220 or a minus 225. And you can see it, you know, you just catch something in the tape, you know, those first 5 minutes of the fight. And you know, you can open, you know, like an open parlay or even play it straight if you really see a difference. But, again, sometimes you see other opportunities. Even though it was a loser last week, I thought it was a good bet with Open St. Preux and the UFC Fight Night 104 card. He was, after the first round, I think before the fight he was somewhere in the neighborhood of minus 330. After the first round he was just minus 130. He ended up losing a split decision, which I thought he won. But, again, it was a line that was $2 lower, which ultimately, you know, was a fairly close fight in the end, you know, much better than a minus 330. Like I said, ultimately lost, but there definitely are some live opportunities when you see them. So, yeah, you can look at it that way, too. You know, play something before the fight and then change it up mid-fight. You know, we're lucky that we do have those options at some books with live betting.
So there are some very, very big favorites here on this card. This is something that we haven't seen a ton here in the first few events of 2017. And also going back to the last few events of 2016, is there any chance that Jacare loses as a minus 525
no.
favorite? Okay.
No.
Good. We can move on from that one. Unless you want to talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, there's some thought process about Jacare, you know, the under 1.5, the total, which I think is interesting. With that said, I'm going to be looking for an under a little different. It's going to be a little more juice than the under 1.5. It would be fight doesn't go round 3. It's a prop that should be coming out tomorrow. Tim Boesch, his last 7 fights, his last seven fights haven't seen the third round. Some of them have seen the latter part of the second round now, which makes me a little more hesitant than just under 1.5. So it's really just buying, and at 7.5 minutes to 10 minutes, you're getting for the fight to end. So I do like that. And I do see Jacare as an easy parlay piece. He's an elite fighter, and he's not losing here. I actually think all three big favorites win. I already bet that myself earlier this week. So Jacare, Dustin Poirier, who's the lead on the pay-per-view card, and Wilson Hayes all together. And that paid about minus 150 for the three of them parlayed. I think that's a winner. I'm not really a person who likes to link three fights into a parlay, but this is a rare exception. I really see a big advantage in all three of those for the favorite.
Well, a minus 150 would lead to a 60% win percentage if all three of them win, and that sounds like, given the individual odds and the work that you do to break down these cards, sounds like that would be a pretty good way to go, and certainly a pretty reasonable price tag there, minus 150. What about Glover Teixeira? He's about a minus 190 favorite here in his fight. What do you think about that one? Do we get a live dog here in this one, or does the chalk hold up again?
Yeah, this is a tough one, I think, because we've seen in some recent fight cards, established, older kind of fighters have struggled a bit with, I guess, a relative UFC newcomer, like the St. Preux fight from last week as an example. But Glover is a top five light heavyweight. He's facing a fighter who had originally fought a heavyweight in the UFC, moved down to light heavyweight in his last fight. Looked really impressive against a tough I forget where that event was, but against this guy Ian Kulava from Moldova, and was pretty impressive. But this is a massive step up in competition, so it's a tough one to say. Could Glover get caught? He is coming off a pretty bad KO to Anthony Johnson, who pretty much knocks out everybody. So, I guess you could make a case for either fighter in this bout. This is one that I'm staying away from. Just in terms of technical ability, Glover is just a lot more well-rounded. I'd be surprised if he lost. But, Cannonier is definitely an interesting type of fighter because he is really athletic. He packs a decent punch. He's a pretty good athlete. This could be the case where, Cannonier makes a big jump and maybe is a contender. That's not really, my favorite fight on the card. So that's the skip.
Well, judging by the line here, maybe this one could be the one with the most fireworks. Certainly the Silva Brunson fight and the main event should have their fair share of fireworks. But Randy Brown and Bilal Muhammad, what do you see here in this fight?
Yeah, this is a good fight. I rate these guys fairly similarly, but I do see the advantage for Randy Brown in this particular bout. His length in this weight class is impressive, and I think it's a big difference maker in this bout because, Muhammad is a really good work rate, but his striking defense leaves a lot to be desired. He is really hittable, and Randy Brown, long, packs a decent punch, and is a striker first and foremost. So I think Muhammad kind of struggles with high-end strikers, and I'm not going to say Brown is a super high-end striker, but he's certainly above average. And just given the physical advantage for Randy Brown here too, I definitely give him a nod. I think Muhammad would do better against better fighters than Randy Brown, though. So because Brown just isn't as well-rounded. His ground game does leave a lot to be desired, while Muhammad is, more capable in that realm. So I would say Muhammad may have a better UFC career ultimately than Randy Brown. I think Brown has the advantage in this bout. It's not a guarantee, but you're right, though. I do expect this to be a pretty action-packed fight, so this should at least be exciting for the fans.
I want to make sure that we don't run out of time here for this segment without talking about Ian McCall. Does he still have the mustache?
He has the mustache, but his opponent wants to rip it off his face. So,
okay.
I don't know.
So
if
that could
have
be
it
an interesting fight then.
Yeah, this is really interesting because Ian McCall hasn't fought in 2 years. I know it seems like a really long time, and McCall's been booked in a ton of different fights, and you know, for various different reasons, whether it was him being injured still or someone being sick or his opponent being out or there was a work visa issue at one point, he hasn't fought. And he's gone through a lot of medical issues over the last couple of years. He's to the point where he's had so many different operations that he can't even make a closed fist with his hand, which is pretty scary considering the fact that he's a fighter and they get paid to, you know, to hit other people. So it's hard to do that when you can't close your hand all the way. But McCall at his peak was probably a top three, top four flyweight in the world. Gave Demetrius Johnson a real run for his money several years ago. But he hasn't fought in 2 years. It's really tough to know where he's at. You have to think he's probably, you know, one or two fights away from retirement. He's facing a 23-year-old undefeated fighter out of the Midwest who's actually fought in Japan, in Russia as well. You know, he has a decent level of experience for a fighter that young. He's a pretty resilient guy, pretty powerful wrestler, a really good overhand right too. So I think he's a really game, you know, fighter, and I think he's going to make this a dogfight with Ian McCall. You know, if McCall is still anywhere where he was 3-4 years ago, I think he'd win, but I don't think he is. And that I think that's why I'm leaning towards the newcomer, Jared Brooks, getting the win here. Brooks is going to be fighting at 100%. He's obviously going to be super motivated. McCall doesn't have those intangibles here. And I think he could be in for a tough out here. So I'm going to go with Jared Brooks here getting the win in an upset. And McCall is very, very difficult to finish. So I think Brooks wins here by decision. So I would look at Brooks by decision as opposed to Brooks straight up and at the plus 140 line.
Are there any other newcomers on the card? Because you write some phenomenal scouting reports over there at MMA Oddsbreaker on the new fighters. Are there any others that you've been able to profile here for this event?
There's only one other new fighter besides Jared Brooks on this fight card. It's Justin Willis. He's a 6'4" heavyweight, 82.5-inch reach, which is one of the longest in the division. So physically, he looks like a really imposing fighter. He's only fought 5 times in his career. He's 4-1, lost his debut, his professional debut, but he's won his last 4 fights. He's facing a pretty good Russian heavyweight. Marcin Tibur is a pretty good prospect in his own right. Did really well in Europe. Lost once in the UFC. But outside of that, you know, he's definitely looked good in his last couple fights. So I think it's going to be a pretty entertaining fight. Unfortunately, the line hasn't been released on that yet. So I can't really comment on, you know, how I would, you know, would bet that fight since
Where do you think the line will be?
Tibur is going to be favored for sure. My guess would probably be in the minus 180 range, I would say, somewhere around there, close to 2-1, just because I think Tibur is a pretty crafty, experienced fighter, even at a relatively young age. And Willis is still rather untested. Physically, he looks, you know, pretty imposing, but he just isn't really that tested. So, plus, Willis is coming in on pretty short notice. I think it's just a week or 10 days, so that's very little time. And generally, fighters that come in on that short of notice don't really fare well in their UFC debuts.
Any other notes on any of the fights that we didn't talk about?
One underdog. I usually like to give out one underdog play, you know, on each fight card. There's a fighter here who's, you know, I think should be a very slight underdog, but he's a really significant underdog, and that I think that the number is the reason you should look at it. Is Nick Lentz. He's facing a fighter from Dagestan. I generally really like the Dagestani fighters as a whole. Where Khabib Nurmagomedov is from. And a bunch of the other fighters that are from there, they all kind of have that physical grinding kind of style. The fighter's name is Islam Makhachev. And Makhachev has ballooned. I think the line opened at minus 160. He's moved all the way to over a 3-1 favorite in this bout over Lentz. And that's really interesting to me because Lentz and Makhachev really have similar styles. They're both grinding fighters. Nick Lentz, collegiate wrestler, I believe, out of the University of Minnesota, but I forget off the top of my head, but it's a pretty, you know, pretty high level collegiate wrestler. And so it's kind of two fighters with a similar kind of a game plan. And I think Lentz is the physically stronger fighter. He's not as good of a striker as Makhachev is, but I think this fight's going to be really all about the grappling. And I think Glenn's, because of his physicality, has a slight advantage in that regard. So that line has ballooned all the way to nearly 2.5 to 1. I believe that's the number. I'm just pulling it up right now. Let's see.
Yeah, it's currently plus 240 at the SI.
Yeah, and I see at other spots it's almost plus 260. So you're getting a really nice number there on a fight, which I think is very, very close and almost too close to call. So plus 240 to plus 250 that's right in the wheelhouse for a nice dog opportunity on this card.
So, Jay, I mentioned the scouting reports that you do over at MMAOddsBreaker.com, but what other content you guys have going on right now?
Yeah, absolutely. I have a couple fight previews as well. I have one on the Jacare fight, and I have one on the Anderson Silva, Derek Brunson fight. So, just a little write-up on each of the two fighters, what their strengths are, and then my overall thoughts on the fight and a recommended bet, on each of those bouts. And so you can find that from me. There's obviously other content. There's, betting content in terms of what you should look at for fight of the night or, a certain total on a particular fight. There's also some great content from one of my colleagues over there, James Lynch. He does interviews with most of the fighters, on these cards. They're video interviews. So you can see how the fighter reacts to his questions and, obviously all different types of, commentary about, their backgrounds and, all that type of stuff. So you can usually find a couple tidbits in each of those videos, and they're really worth your time. So I highly recommend you check those out at MMAOddsBreaker.com.
And at Jay Primetown on Twitter, at MMAOddsBreaker on Twitter. Jay, thank you so much for joining us, man. Really appreciate it. Enjoy your snow day. Stay safe, stay warm, and we'll talk to you again real soon.
Absolutely, Adam. Enjoy.
Good stuff there from Jay Primetown of MMAOddsBreaker.com. Truthfully, I usually use the end of this show to tell you what's coming up the next day, but honestly, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. No Rob Pozzola this week. As I said, he's got a prior commitment that he needs to take care of, so we won't hear from him, but we'll figure something out. We always do. If you do have other questions, maybe throw them my way. Not going to do another full mailbag segment, I wouldn't think, but if you do have some other questions, I realize there was one in my Twitter mentions that I missed, so I'll talk about that one on tomorrow's show. But if you do have anything you want to know, reach out on Twitter at Skating Tripods or at Bang the Book, and we'll answer those for you. So thank you very much for listening, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.